This episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon the best of His creation, Prophet Muhammad, and His pure progeny. Patience and perseverance, tolerance and forbearance are common traits of the world's most successful people. Patience is a very high quality of man. Sometimes one errs in differentiating between patience on one hand and laziness in action, tolerating oppression and relying on luck on the other. Whereas patience and forbearance guarantees victory and success, while laziness and inaction causes misfortune and results in failure. Now we shall explain the difference between these two opposing qualities, illustrating them through different examples. A gardener desires that there be so many flowers in his garden that it always remains fragrant and the different colors of the flowers please the eyes and the atmosphere of the garden remains good. If the gardener wants it to be so, he must work hard. He should endure the sun and the heat and the cold and the rain. He must become habituated to the pricking of thorns also, and he ought to visit his garden often. Hardships that one must endure to attain the goal are termed as patience. If a trader wishes to earn profits and increase his wealth, he must undertake arduous land, sea, and air journeys. If a student desires good marks, a diplomat intends to woo the people, they must work hard with utmost steadfastness and determination. Regarding this, Hafiz Shirazi, the outstanding Persian poet, says, "Patience and success are friends of each other. Success comes as a result of patience." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, Saeed Barrizo here. We'll kick things off here in the UK. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that COVID-19 deaths over the winter could be twice as high as the first wave. 23,000 people tested positive Sunday and 162 lost their lives. Number 10 has informed the public that in England, the tier system is to be ditched as of Thursday, with the country entering its second national lockdown. Bianca Rahimi reports on the new restrictions and the mounting criticism of the government.
Faced with these latest figures, there is no alternative but to take further action at a national level. I believe it was right to try every possible option to get this virus under control at a local level with strong local action and strong local leadership. And I reject any suggestion that we are somehow slower in taking measures than our European friends and partners.
Some say this is too little, too late, though, and the lockdown will now have to be longer and harder as a result.
Scientific advisers said were necessary back in September, so the government has delayed and dithered. Just as in the first phase, where they were too slow, they've repeated the same mistake.
MPs will debate and vote on the new measures on Wednesday, with several Conservatives expected to rebel against what they call a disastrous course of action. The British public have been warned, though, that the lockdown could be extended if the restrictions don't yield results, threatening a not very merry Christmas.
If we ensure that all the steps that we're taking now are taken appropriately, we'll have an opportunity in advance of December the 2nd to review the progress that we're making, and in advance of December the 2nd, we can then communicate to those areas where some restrictions may be required, what they will be, and also other areas where we've managed to beat back the virus, we can explain where liberties can be restored.
Meanwhile, 16,000 people in Britain are said to have died because of the restrictions on healthcare brought about by the previous lockdown and following restrictions. It's estimated another 26,000 could die by next March. The government has defended the measures, though, saying many more would have died if the restrictions had not been in place. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, let's get some thoughts on that story. Lembit Opec is a former British MP and the political analyst joining me with his thoughts. Good to have you with us. So we just heard what Mr. Johnson said, that he rejects any suggestion that they have been slow in announcing the lockdown the previous time, this time. What do you think?
He would say that, wouldn't he? In reality, here on this very show, I made it quite clear that the biggest failing isn't choosing a particular strategy, but changing that strategy. I would argue that defending the most vulnerable and letting the rest of us be potentially exposed to it might make sense. But what certainly doesn't work is stop-start, and that's what we've got here. And if it's right to have a lockdown now, it would have been right to have a lockdown a month ago as well. So Prime Minister's defending his position. Incidentally, I don't think Labour would have done any better. I don't have much faith that Keir Starmer's got a better strategy. He's sniping from the sidelines. But as far as the question you're concerned applies, yes, we should have done it sooner, and it will cost lives because we didn't.
And, well, you've tested positive for COVID. I wonder, I think we can see signs of it right now as we look at you. First of all, how are you holding up, and has the virus changed your view with regards to a national lockdown?
Yeah, the truth is I feel terrible. I've got a fever, I've got a searing headache, my muscles are sore. It's changed my attitude towards this virus. This is the worst I have felt in terms of illness since I had dysentery 25 years ago. It's that serious, and that also is potentially fatal. Just in terms of the other question, has it changed my view about lockdown? Well, in a sense, I feel there is more immediacy. Having experienced it and experiencing now, I don't know how long I'm going to be ill. I know that this, I can see why this is going to kill people. I'm 55, I'm reasonably healthy, and it's knocked me out. If you told me to come to the studio today, of course I'm not allowed to, it's illegal, I would have turned it down because I can only walk from the other room to here, and then I have to rest again. So, yes, I think it's persuasive to say until we have a vaccine, we have to have a lockdown, given the fact that the government walked away from herd immunity in the first place. Mm-hmm.
And, Lembit, apart from the human cost that they're trying, perhaps, to prevent by imposing this lockdown, there's the financial cost of shutting down the country. Will the UK economy be able to survive this lockdown? Especially if it's extended beyond the December 2nd time that they're going to bring the country back out of lockdown.
The UK economy will survive, but in what state? It seems to me we're bound to have another contraction. And maybe that's a price worth paying if tens of thousands of lives already say. We had to call an ambulance last night for my mother-in-law at 4 in the morning. And that really focuses me, keep touching on your previous question. The mission here is to save lives. But maybe we can. Maybe we can have a high. We identify who's genuine. We let the rest take the chances if they choose to. And then we can save the economy to an extent as well. Where will we be in 2 months' time? Further recession. Probably another 100,000 million in debt, or potentially more. I was right the last time I made these predictions on the show. I hope I'm not right again. but I can't see any alternative. My one plea to the government is don't keep changing strategy, because that way, whatever you do, you'll lose.
All right. Thank you very much, Slembit Opec, former MP and political commentator. Thanks for coming on. Moving on now, as Europe continues to grapple with the second wave of COVID, protesters are holding rallies across the bloc to denounce the lack of financial help from their governments. In Italy, hundreds of business owners have marched in Rome to ask for financial support from the government.
If the government closes us, we need to receive an income. The government should give financial support to the people who have to choose whether to work or get sick.
In Spain, protesters have run riot in the northern city of Logroño hours after the government declared a state of national emergency. Video footage of the chaos showed demonstrators throwing stones and looting stores. The country's prime minister, Pedro Sanchez, condemned the violence and described their actions as intolerable. To other news, as anger continues to spread over insults against the Prophet Muhammad in France, the country's president, Emmanuel Macron, takes to Arabic language airwaves in a bid to placate critics and dampen growing anti-France sentiments.
When we talk about cartoons, many newspapers and magazines, including Charlie Hebdo, have caricatured the Christian God, the Jewish religion, rabbis, and so on. They have also caricatured Prophet Muhammad and the Muslim religion. I understand the feelings that stir up. My role is to calm things down, but to also protect freedom of speech. I understand and respect that one might be shocked by these cartoons, but I will never accept physical violence as a response.
France has seen a worrying spike in targeted violence, with the latest attack coming Friday with an Orthodox priest who was shot and injured in the city of Lyon. Macron has faced criticism for stoking tensions prior to this latest interview. In response, a growing list of Muslim-majority countries are calling for a boycott of French products. Let's find out how social media has reacted to that story. Robert Carter joins me now with all the details. Robert?
Thanks, Saeed. So obviously, global Muslim outrage has continued well into this week, with huge protests taking place in Bangladesh and also Pakistan, again expressing deep outrage and condemnation of France and its anti-Muslim campaign, but also of the French President Emmanuel Macron, following his statements over the weekend, where he, according to Western media, attempted to soften his rhetoric to try and reach out to the global Muslim community amid the ongoing outrage, the call to boycott French products, which has been a very successful campaign on social media over the past week or so. But I'm here to say that actually, if you listen through what the French president was saying during his speech, he still not only defended the so-called freedom of speech to attack Islam and its holiest figures, but also he renewed his criticism of Islam and also of French Muslims. And I have a little clip from his speech to a journalist, which I'll play out now just to give you an example.
They teach that we must not respect France or French law, and that we must somehow get out of these laws. They teach that women are not equal to men. They teach that little girls should not have the same rights as little boys. Not our values. We believe in enlightenment and that women have the same rights as men.
That didn't sound like an apology, Robert. Tell us about what social media has been saying about this.
Absolutely. So obviously, a lot of people have realized that despite the fact that Macron claims that he's reaching out to Muslims, he's not demonizing all of Islam and all Muslims. As you heard from the comments there, he still believes that French society is more enlightened than Muslim society. And he added further on that if Muslims don't agree with the way France is conducting itself at the moment, they should essentially leave and go and practice Islam somewhere else, which is essentially an invitation to French Muslims to get out and leave. leave if they don't like the so-called persecution. That's been reflected on social media. Let's go to the first tweet I have, which has expressed criticism. It says, from Abdullah here, it says that Macron should have taken the chance to apologize and put this all to bed once and for all. He decided not to, but I think he is getting scared. Then the next comments I have is from YouTube, again a platform where there's been a lot of criticism of Macron expressed. The first YouTube comment I have says that he is a president with a barber's brain. His head needs beating with shoes to bring it into order. This is freedom of speech, isn't it? So again, a little play on the whole idea of, well, if Macron is going to defend freedom of speech, surely he should be defending the right to criticize him as well. And then the final YouTube comment I have is from Noura, who says, salam to everyone. Indeed, they can't stop Muslims. Macron wants to make it acceptable to insult or abuse Muslims in any way, but when it comes to criticism of Macron himself or the French flag, for example, it's banned. Why did France remove its diplomat from Turkey, for example? Erdogan was expressing free speech, referencing Erdogan's recent insults.
Exactly. Let's move on to your second story. Tell us why Palestinians are suing the British government, Robert.
Absolutely. So today is actually the 103rd anniversary of the historical Balfour Declaration, which was essentially a document signed by the British Foreign Secretary at the time, over 100 years ago now, Sir Arthur Balfour, who basically got the ball rolling in the creation of the of Israel, you know, the colonialist project, which is essentially stealing and occupying Palestinian land. So this anniversary represents the long, over 100 year legacy of brutal colonialist projects, which was started by the British, which of course has led to misery for the Palestinians ever since. So obviously, anyone who doesn't know, very quickly, Arthur Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary at the time. This over 100 years ago, during World War One, and even before Britain invaded and occupied Palestine after defeating the Ottomans during that war, Britain had essentially signed a secret deal with a Zionist political movement here in the UK, pledging that they would create or seek to create a Jewish homeland, as they called it. But obviously that was on a...
Robert, I hate to cut you off, but we're fast running out of time for this segment. Tell us what social media has been saying about this story.
Absolutely. So obviously a lot of criticism, as you can imagine, an attempt by Palestinian activists to raise this issue online. So the first one I have from Enos says that, yes, you have to remember your savagery, how you killed Palestine, displaced Palestinians and destroyed their homes. Also, you have to remember the ethnic cleansing. Shame on you, referring to the UK here. And then the second tweet I have is from Nawal, who again is criticizing, saying that what is the point of apologizing? The damage is done and we cannot forgive. Too late after all the suffering of Palestinians that has taken place and is still taking place until today.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Robert Carter with those stories. Robert, thank you. Let's take a look at some other stories. Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, says Armenia has admitted defeat in the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh by requesting help from Russia. He promised his forces would go to the end should negotiations fail to result in an agreement that would see ethnic Armenian forces withdraw from Nagorno-Karabakh. In response, Russia's foreign ministry has said it would provide all assistance required should the conflict spill onto the territory of Armenia. Russian authorities estimate the conflict has so far resulted in the deaths of 5,000 troops and civilians from both sides. Hundreds of people have been sheltering in tents after last week's powerful earthquake near Turkey's Aegean coast, which also hit a number of Greek islands. More than 3,000 tents and 13,000 beds have been supplied to provide temporary shelter as rescuers continue to look for survivors. Earlier, a three-year-old girl was pulled from the rubble 65 hours after the magnitude 6.9 quake. So far, 76 people have lost their lives, with close to 1,000 people injured. Police violence and deaths in custody in the UK is once again under the spotlight as the United Family and Friends campaign seeks to raise the issue of ongoing injustices experienced by many families at the hands of the state. Richard Sedan brings us this update.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family Campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was six times more likely. And of course, that because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, "You can't touch it." They had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, "You do know this is all self-inflicted. You do know that he did this to himself." And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
The justification for black deaths in custody and the rationale behind it, you know, is all developed within the sort of racist context of a white privilege that assumes that white people can never be guilty of any sin when it comes to inflicting violence against black people. And that's an attitude and a lived experience we've lived with since we were on the plantations, you know, way back in the 17th century. And it's continued from that day right up until this day.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold.
Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
On to the U.S. elections now, and how the country is bracing itself for election night, mass protests and riots. For the details, let's bring in Robert Inlakesh. Robert, tell us what's going on.
Well, regardless of which candidate actually wins, it is projected that there will be violence on the streets of many of the different cities in the United States. And of course, we know that there are a number of different militia groups, right-wing militia groups, which are ready to go in favor of Trump. We've already sort of seen a taste of what they're capable of on the streets. And on top of that as well, we have this whole entire situation, the flames of it all fanned by Donald Trump by calling a lot of leftist protesters who come out onto the streets and end up getting into scuffles and attacking right-wing people, describing them as Antifa and BLM terrorists. So when these people are being described as terrorists, of course, this is really exacerbating the situation. Right now, it's very tense, but it is expected that the elections on election night, or when the election results are coming in, that this election is going to be hotly contested regardless of what the actual
Watching from outside, Robert, it looks like a powder keg waiting to explode, but we'll see how that will go down. Bring us the online conversation of this.
So we got two comments here, one from each side of the argument. First one here we have is from an account called Trump Lies, People Die. They say, dangerous Donald Trump is riling up his base for disruptions, riots if he doesn't win the election on Tuesday. White supremacist, radical right-wing militias, Proud Boy, etc. will likely cause serious problems like on this bridge in New York today. I'm really worried and afraid. We have another one here as well by a user called Danny Black who says that the left in 2020, vandalism, arson, murder, assaults, looting, statues pulled down, people dragged from cars, dinners in restaurants, forced to kneel or put their fists in the air. Also, the left in 2020, Trump's militias are going to kick off if he loses.
Well, that one tweet covers a lot of ground, doesn't it, Robert? Your second story, Twitter has suspended the accounts of dozens of Palestinians and pro-Palestinian activists. Tell us why.
Well, actually, there was a request which was put in from the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs. The regime itself had requested through its ministry to Twitter that they take down 170 Palestinian accounts, pro-Palestine accounts, which accused, of course, of being fake accounts. However, that's not been the case. A lot of prominent Palestinians, including from in the Gaza Strip and West Bank, have had their accounts taken down. Also, on top of this, Palestinian media accounts, which are writing in English, have been taken down, such as Shihab Agency, which was taken down just yesterday from Twitter, their English handle. And also, Quds News has been taken down, many different accounts of it taken down. Very legitimate organizations which are bringing Palestinian perspective. And that's what we see, that they are attacking the Palestinian perspective, Palestinian voices, and making sure they delegitimize the message of Palestinians so that they can dehumanize them and justify the Israeli crimes against humanity committed against the Palestinian people.
Well, we're talking about Twitter suspending those accounts. Bring us some tweets on this story.
The first one we have here commenting on this is from an account called Cynthia Wilson, who says, Twitter aims to at annihilating the Palestinian narrative and deleting all stuff related to Palestine. Hashtag Twitter censors Palestine. Got another one here as well who says that Twitter's suspension of Palestinian accounts is a blatant violation that aims to suppress the Palestinian content and hide a narrative that exposes the real face of the Israeli occupation. Again, with the same hashtag there.
Hashtag seems to be taking off, Robert. Robert Inlakesh with those stories, Robert. Thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children, because the children of every community are the future of that community. The answers that you'll be listening to are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in the studio with us our guest speaker, Brother Maghdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Brother Maghdad, salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for being with us.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, so here's the question that we have for today. It reads, how do I prepare my child for the ultimate war when the 12th Imam will come back? So, awaiting the 12th Imam is one of the duties that is emphasized on in the Shia ideology. And I guess this is where this question is coming from. The Imam Mahdi is going to be the savior who brings justice to the world. How do we prepare our children for him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an interesting question, but I'd like to rephrase the question. I don't think the focus in intidhar is war as such. The focus in waiting for the 12th Imam is not for a war. I think it's a kind of a misconception that sometimes people have that we're waiting for the ultimate final battle. You know, like some movies are like that. Unfortunately, we have a few Hollywood movies about that, the end of the world, where we're preceded by a battle that will take place. These are very foreign concepts. That is not to say that a battle won't take place. However, the roles and responsibility that we have right now is not as such to train our children to become soldiers in the meaning of warriors of battle and that kind of stuff. That's not how we prepare for the return and for the Zuhur of the 12th Imam. We have to understand what is this role of the Imam, right? And I think the key for this preparation is to realize the gap of not having an Imam, right? You see, intidhar and waiting for the Imam only makes sense when you understand that you don't have something that you want. And perhaps you can say that the main reason, or one of the main reasons of why the Imam went in the ghiba in the first place, is because people didn't appreciate the presence of the Imam. Whether he was there or he wasn't there, it was the same for us. Okay, us meaning the people at that time. It didn't make a difference that you had an Imam or you didn't have an Imam, right? And so it's as if you can say in a very childish way, you can say that Allah took Imam away just so we can actually understand why do we need an Imam in the first place. And so intidhar, the way we need to understand it in today's world is that we need to create an understanding of the role of the Imam in our lives and to feel the need for it, right? You can summarize this, that if we are able to make people realize the need of the Imam will come straight away. Just like when the people of Kufa woke up to the need of the Imam and they called out to Imam al-Hussein, Imam al-Hussein straight away came up, right? He quickly packed everything in Medina and went towards Kufa. Why? Because the people were calling out to him in a way that they felt the need for the Imam. Say, we want you now, and we know we need you, right? Now, obviously, they turned around and betrayed the Imam. But that's another story. The point over here is that if we want the Imam to come back, and if we are our children to be true awaiters, we need our children to understand the need of the Imam. They should feel a gap. And so when you say Al-Ajal, and when you say, well, Imam, return, okay, and Imam asks you why, you've got a whole answer ready. It's like, obvious, I need you, right?
There are some programs where I feel that it's not just about children. This is material that is useful even for grown-ups and adults. And I think this is one of those programs. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back to discuss about the gap of the absence of Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. englishradio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, where we try to address the issues that parents have, the questions that they have in regards to raising their children. The question today was, how can we prepare our children for the return of Imam Mahdi? In the first part, you explained very beautifully that the return of Imam Mahdi isn't about war, although there will be some battles, but it's not about war. And what we should do is that we should teach our children about the gap, the emptiness, that is because of the absence of our Savior, our Imam Zaman, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. So the natural question here is, what is the gap which is the result of the absence of Imam Mahdi that we want to teach our children?
Right. Obviously, the gaps are many. The Imam fills all the gaps at every dimension of human existence, right? But when it comes to our children, let me point out a few of these gaps that we can teach our children. The first one, and probably the most common one and the most obvious one, is social justice, right? And this is a slogan that we all have, that the Imam will come and bring about social justice. So the first thing is that we need to understand that there is a lack of justice in this world, right? And so one of the things that we need to teach our children is the situation in the world, right? What is happening around us. Now, having said that, I really, really strongly and very, very in bold and italics and in red written, warn the parents to be very careful in how they do this, because it requires a lot of skill to make sure children don't become in despair, number one, or don't become completely scared of what's happening, because these are very emotional, right? Sometimes you have children from the age of 6 that have seen really emotionally disturbing images, for example, that can actually have bad effects, right? So teaching children of what's happening in the world has to come slowly, but it needs to come, right? Children, when they reach the age of 10, 11, even earlier sometimes, they need to understand that there are things happening in this world, okay? And certain things are leading, or certain factors, or certain individuals, or certain countries are leading to having injustice in this world, right? And justice and injustice is a very innate concept. You don't have to explain what does justice mean, right? When you see, for instance, an occupation happening where a foreign army comes into the land of somebody and takes away their land or takes away their possession and commits violence, for example, commits crimes, then you know this is injustice happening there, right? So the first thing is to understand the injustice that's happening in the world. Second is to understand where it's coming from. Unfortunately, the first part most of us do. I mean, children in the West, children everywhere around the world, they're kind of aware of what's happening in the world. If you tell them Syria, they know. If you tell them Palestine, they know. If you tell them Kashmir, they kind of know what's happening, right? But then you tell them who's guilty. You tell them what's causing all of this. This is where it becomes a bit more tricky. So another thing that we need to be very careful is to be give them the full picture and make sure that they're aware of what's causing these injustice, right? Anyhow, the first point, or the first gap that we need children to understand, is that there is an injustice happening in this world. And what's crucial over here is to make sure that this understanding comes, that this injustice cannot be removed unless and except by the 12th Holy Imam, by the infallible. Again, this is the third stage, and this is where many of us make a mistake, right? We claim that democracy, or we claim that United Nations or the Red Cross will come and solve the world, and we'll have peace at the end of the world because of these things. And we need to make sure that we don't fall into this media false propaganda, right? No, to be very fair, so far nothing's worked, and the way it's going, it's not going to work, okay? And we have a firm belief that justice will be fully and over everywhere established through the Holy Imam. And therefore, if we want justice, we want the 12th Imam.
But not to go excessively to the other side, does this promote ineptness in trying to bring justice to the community?
No, definitely. That's a very good point. It doesn't mean that we stand idle and just watch, right? That comes in explaining of what's going to happen to encourage the 12th Imam to come back. So when we talk about, okay, now that we understood we have a gap, we know that this gap will be filled only by the 12th Imam. Now the child asks, okay, but what do we do for the 12th Imam to come back? And the answer for the parents is that we try and walk on the steps of the 12th Imam, help him to get to that, to fulfill that gap, and that will lead to the Dhuhr.
And we'll cover that after the break. Let's just take a short break, and we'll be back for the rest of the explanation. Don't go away.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
You're back on IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about how to prepare our children for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. First point is that Imam Mahdi is not going to be all about war. It's going to be a lot about understanding the gap of the absence of Imam Mahdi. So now that our children know about the gap and they know that justice can only come, worldwide justice can only come through Imam Mahdi, the next question is going to be, then what do we do by the time he arrives?
So we encourage children to work towards justice, work towards social justice. And this could be a very simple thing of helping the poor, for example. It could be as simple as participating in a rally, for example, to help the oppressed people in Nigeria, for example. It could be, bringing awareness to my family and friends about what's happening in the world so that they also feel the need for the 12th Imam. It can be different things. I don't want to go into too much details. I think people can, or parents can work on this aspect. It's quite obvious. I want to come to another stage where we talked about a gap, which is a social gap, right? What we need to understand is that this is not the only gap that the 12th Imam fills, right? There's other gaps that we need to also open the door for. Things like personal spirituality or our perfection and our guidance, right? There's a lot of the thing that 12th Imam does in his presence that if we don't have the 12th Imam, then we're losing out, right? Things like our understanding of reality, things like our spiritual perfection, right? I mean, it's very different when you go to the 12th Imam and asks him, when he is there, physically present, and you ask him exactly what you need to do, what you need to focus, and answer, you get all your answer questioned by him, right? It's very different because it's an infallible speaking to you. And so making children realize this is one of the gaps as well, that the lack of the 12th Imam amongst us is very much felt by all of us, that we are not able to understand reality properly, or we're not able to achieve spirituality the way we would be able to if he was back. And therefore, this creates a need for the 12th Imam to come back. And we feel the need to ask the Imam, please do come back. Because not only we want social justice, but we also want spiritual perfection. We also want all of us to go closer to Allah and understand the reality better and be better Muslims. And that can happen with the presence of the Imam.
All right, thank you very much. That's all the time that we have. Unfortunately, if you missed the program, you can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, that's parstoday.com, and find our page, Call of Islam. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
جنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة. وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gates of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We were discussing about the qualities and the signs of those who are pious based on the sermon number 184 in Nahjul Balagha, famously known as the sermon of the pious people or Khutbatul Muttaqin. And of course we reached this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says وَزَهَادَتُهُ فِي مَا لَا يَبْقَى, that the pious person, one who observes piety, is one who is ascetic with regards to death which is temporary. In other words, here Imam Ali alayhi salam is giving us a litmus test for those who are pious. What do they love? What are they attached to? What do they like? What are they ready to sacrifice their lives for? When it comes to choosing between that which is temporary and that which is permanent, what do they choose? In different areas of their lives. And therefore, if a person were to use this litmus test in his or her daily life to see that what decisions are pious and which are not, he or she will find that this is a wonderful criterion to be able to decide what is good and what is bad, what decision is pious and what decision is not. Very simply, inshallah, in the next segment after the break, I'll give you a few examples of this.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when it comes to those decisions that we make in our day-to-day lives, and how this criterion of liking that which is permanent becomes a very powerful and potent criterion in the way we become pious, I would like to give some examples. So, for instance, if a person wants to wake up for prayer, and prayer is something which is attachment to God, who is the source of existence, who is the source of all perfections that a human being can perceive. But at the same time, a person feels like sleeping and resting and enjoying that special, state of sleep at that moment in the morning. If he would ask himself at that time that the decision that I'm making right now, let us say to sleep and not to wake up, is that because of my liking towards the temporary, me liking that which is temporal? If it is the case, then that decision is an impious decision. And if a person says that if I wake up it is because of my attachment and love for God. And therefore he takes that step, then that was a pious step. And many other things when it comes to anger, when it comes to dealing with children, when it comes to, let us say, family life, right? Some things are more, you can say, concomitant, or they are more, you can say, related and synchronic to our internal, let's say, feelings and those desires and states, material states like anger. It's easier to shout at someone and satisfy that feeling inside, that material kind of feeling that exists in a person, because of course he feels uncomfortable and therefore wants to remove that discomfort by that anger. When a person does that and therefore hurts someone else and therefore satisfies that temporary state in him and leaves out that permanent goodness that he would get if he would have controlled his anger, this decision becomes an impious decision. You see, and you continue comparing like this, and you will see how this criterion is such a wonderful and practical criterion in dealing with issues in this world, especially when a person wants to make decisions that are pious.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
As such, dear brothers and sisters, a person now, when he has this criterion in mind, he will realize that what is his vigor for? What are his interests? What makes his heart beat? Are there temporary issues? Fleeting issues, destructible issues, issues that expire and diminish and get destroyed, or are the issues that are permanent, that stay and remain? How much is he concerned and attached to the soul? How much does he love the soul and its corollaries and its effects? And how much does he like the body and its effects? And how much is he concerned about the mount? And how much for the one who mounts, or the mounter? The example of the mount and the mounter is like the body and the soul. The body is the mount, and the mounter is the one who is on the body. If a person is just concerned about making his donkey fat, right? Making his donkey fat, and he forgets about himself, who is the one who is taking the journey, then look at how weak this person is in mind, in his mind, and how weak he is in piety. And that's why Allah, you see, there's a narration from the Ahlul Bayt that says, إِنَّ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ لَمْ يَطْمَأَنُوا فِي الدُّنْيَا وَلَمْ يَأْمَنُوا قُدُومَ الْآخِرَةِ دار الدنيا دار زوال ودار الآخرة دار قرار. The believers are not attached to this world and are not at peace with this world, but they are actually concerned about the hereafter, because they know that this world is fleeting and the hereafter is remaining. Therefore, put the world in its place as what? As a place that is fleeting and goes away. Just like a person who stays temporarily in a place and then he has to go away from that place, just like a hotel or something like that. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives us the opportunity to address and understand the world the way it is, so we can live in a good way. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نبي ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
On the news line. In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US were more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
It absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who was sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
As with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failure is a part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process. With one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction, this is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet is something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the US will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and the Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say U.S. domination of the world's people and resources, there may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. these people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon. A new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million